And I say this as a raw vegan who juiced more kale and spinach than most people. And I got oxalate toxicity from doing this. It is not good for
the best nootropic I've ever tried. Check out this review on Mood, Memory, and Brain from Heart and Soil Supplements from John L. Of all the nootropic supplements I have ever tried on the earth, this was by far the only one that did not make me feel hyper-obsessive nor hypersexual. The mental clarity I experienced was amazing. This is my favorite nootropic ever. As bizarre as that sounds, this nutrition supplement actually gave me a calmer demeanor, caused me to smile more, and I had more of a sense of creativity than I've not had in the past with other nootropics, which, as previously mentioned, came with those other bizarre side effects. This is by far my favorite supplement at Heart and Soil. I am super excited about Mood, Memory, and Brain. This has desiccated brain, liver, and bone marrow in it. All of our organs are sourced from 100% grass-fed, grass-finished, regeneratively raised cattle in New Zealand, packaged in glass, no plastic here. These are the finest desiccated organs on the planet. And desiccated cow brain and the compounds found within it, including phosphatidylserine, have been found to consistently improve cognitive function in humans. The reviews on Mood, Memory, and Brain are amazing. And I'm so glad that people are benefiting from this and all of the supplements that we make at Heart and Soil. Our mission is to help you reclaim your birthright to radical health. You can find us at heartandsoil.co. In the podcast with Dave today, I've been talking a lot about desiccated organs, and you can find us at heartandsoil.co. I think if Dave had a favorite Heart and Soil supplement, it would probably be Mood, Memory, and Brain because of the nootropic benefits, and I'm going to have to send him some. All right, guys, back to the podcast. In this week's podcast, I'm grateful to have my friend Dave Asprey on. He recently wrote a new book called Smarter, Not Harder. We talk about some of the highlights in that book, and we get into all kinds of good stuff in this podcast. We talk about plant defense chemicals, phytic acid, oxalates, why peanut butter is horrible for you. We talk about seed oils even more. We get Dave's opinion on seed oils. We have some healthy disagreement about coffee, and we talk about fructose. We definitely drill down into the fructose rabbit hole a little bit, talk about Dave's perspective on eating fruit and honey, and my perspective in my labs and Dave's labs and all kinds of good stuff. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy this one. We got into a lot of valuable points, and enjoy it. I think Dave's done a lot of good work in the biohacking space and offers a lot of value in his new book. So enjoy this podcast with Dave Asprey. Next week will be Georgi Dinkov, and we'll talk more about fructose from the Ray Pete perspective. So stay tuned for that as well. I want to give a shout out to my sponsors who make this podcast free and accessible. They're all companies and humans and organizations that I believe in greatly and am happy to support. I want to start out with my buddy Monsel, who has a company called sacredhunting.com. And as you might tell from that title, he takes people on hunting trips where you learn the basics of how to track, stalk, kill, and field dress wild game animals. But he adds a ritual and Native American component that makes it a real rite of passage. I've been on two hunts with Monsel. The first one was a bow hunt for deer, and the second one was a rifle hunt for black buck antelope. And I've enjoyed both of them immensely. Just being in the wilderness with Monsel and the community that he curates makes for a very memorable hunting experience. If you've not hunted before, or if you have hunted, this will be a very unique experience for you. So Fundamental Health listeners receive $250 off their trip by mentioning my name, Paul's name. You can go to sacredhunting.com/Paul, fill out the 2-minute application, set up an exploratory call with Monsel. There are two dates specifically set up for listeners of this podcast, May 18th through 21st, 2023, and November 2nd through 5th, 2023. The November 2nd through 5th hunt is co-ed. So if you have a girlfriend or ladies want to join, you can join that one. sacredhunting.com/Paul. Also want to give a shout out to my friends at Bond Charge. That's BONCHARGE.com. They do great work in the EMF reduction space. I'm recording this intro with my laptop in front of me with a EMF reducing or blocking mat from Bond Charge. When I do headphones on my computer, I have Bond Charge's EMF blocking or EMF reducing headphones, which are wired. I'm not a fan of AirPods. I know they're convenient for a lot of you guys, but they do have a significant amount of Bluetooth radiation and EMF. So if you're looking to get back to wires and reduce the non-native EMF into your brain or put a laptop on your lap, definitely check out the folks at Bond Charge, BONCHARGE.com. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD for 15% off your order there, bondcharge.com. CARNIVOREMD gets you 15% off. Also want to give a shout out to my friends at earthrunners.com. These are pretty cool, guys. They are sandals that have grounding built into them. So in congruence with ancestral wisdom, we know that it's pretty good for humans to do nature-based lifestyle practices. And rather than outsourcing all of this to modern technology, we don't think about this, but Our ancestors were always connected with the earth. I realize this when I am not surfing as much, or I'm out of Costa Rica and I'm not in the ocean. There is actually good evidence to suggest that being in contact with the earth is beneficial for humans in terms of mood, in terms of inflammation. It's crazy. I didn't believe it, but the studies are real. And so two things that Earthrunner's done that I think is really cool. They've made a very minimalist Huarache-like sandal, which is something that is mirrored what tribes have done, which gives your foot freedom to move. I love sandals and minimalist footwear. But they've done a copper earthing plug and conductive laces that actually keep you grounded while you're wearing the sandals, which is pretty cool because some places you don't want to be walking barefoot or touching the earth. And so when I am wearing sandals or minimalist footwear, I really appreciate Earthrunners. You can find them at earthrunners.com. That's EARTHRUNNERS.com. And you can use the code carnivore at checkout for 10% off. That's earthrunners.com. Use the code carnivore at checkout for 10% off your order. Last but not least, I want to give a shout out to 8 Sleep. This podcast is brought to you by 8 Sleep. That's EIGHTSLEEP.com. One of the hardest things for me when I'm traveling is that I don't have a good mattress and I'm always hot. And this is why I love my 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover when I'm in Austin, because this is a temperature regulating biometric tracking bed that I have there. And I sleep super well when I use it. So how does it work? It fits on any size mattress and allows you to adjust the temperature of your sleeping environment, providing the optimal temperature that gets you the best night's sleep. The Pod Pro cover has dual zone temperature control. You and your partner can set your sides of the bed independently. You can do 55 degrees Fahrenheit or as hot as 110. 55 is like for you freezer sleepers, and 110, you'd basically be sleeping in a sauna, but maybe you're into that. So you can do biometrics with this and it really will help your overall sleep quality. So you can go to 8sleep.com/carnivoremd and save $150 on the 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover. They currently ship within the US, Canada, the UK, select countries in the EU and Australia. Better sleep is the health habit that you'll love sticking to night after night. Wake up fully energized with the Pod Pro cover so you can tackle whatever life throws at you. Food, nutrition, good sleep, these are the foundations of health and longevity and optimal performance. And I really appreciate the way that 8 Sleep helps us all achieve this. 8sleep.com/carnivoreMD for $150 off your Pod Pro cover. Onto the podcast, my friends. All right, Dave, thanks for coming on the podcast, my friend. It's been too long.
You know, James, I'm always happy to be here.
Anyone that doesn't know that joke isn't going to understand that at all, dude.
I know, right?
You gotta tell people the joke. You're going to explain this, and then we'll get into your stuff.
All right. So when you and I first chatted years ago, I was like, oh, this guy's super cool. And for some reason, I got your first name stuck in my head as James. And then on another podcast, I'm like, yeah, James Saladino. And you're like, Dave, what the hell? So I always call you James on purpose just to you know, be that guy.
Every podcast that Dave and I have done now, this James comes up. It's amazing. And so I'd forgotten about it actually, which is hilarious. And now thank you for reminding me about that. I was like, man, I was so excited. Like Dave Asprey mentioned me on a podcast, but he called me James. And I got so many messages from people.
I felt so bad. I was like, what the hell? At least your last name is Salad. So it's easy to remember you.
I know. And people were like, do you have a brother named James Paul? I was getting messages on social media. Anyway, Robert Asprey, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Nice. Now, you have to know this. Robert Asprey is a well-known really good history writer who's my great uncle. So,
what? Okay. Well, we're channeling ancestors.
Now you confuse two authors, dude. This podcast is going sideways already.
Already. It's good. It's good. So, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
The B word?
You know what I did?
I blended up some maple syrup with, oh, wait. No, I didn't.
You didn't have breakfast, did you?
I had this. This is my new meat-based coffee because coffee was a plan.
Okay, this is a joke for people. But if we could make a meat-based coffee, I would be down with that. So you haven't... I realized the silliness of the question after I asked it. I'm presuming you didn't eat breakfast yet.
I usually don't. This morning, I did an electrical stimulation thing that will radically drop blood sugar, just because like it puts a huge amount of stimulation on muscles. So after that, I had steak.
Okay, cool. So what did you have for dinner last night? Tell me that.
Oh my God. You want to know the truth? I haven't had this for dinner in like 10 years, and it's the exact opposite of what I always have.
Okay.
So I had a whole bunch of this amazing N101 stuff. It's the only nitric oxide formula that I've ever found that works. Like, there's lozenges. It's called N101 from the guy, like, okay, the original nitric oxide science guy. But I had five of them because I was just, and it dropped my blood sugar. So I was like, cause, you know, that much vasodilation will drop blood sugar. So I'm like, man, I need to like get a kick in the pants. So I made pancakes.
Okay.
And I made them out of white rice, actually sweet white rice flour. I used collagen protein from cows, obviously, the bulletproof collagen instead of eggs, because collagen actually is a great binder when you're cooking. And okay, then I used baking powder. I threw a banana in there and I had raw honey on them. And nice. So I only had like 40 grams of collagen maybe and a huge plate of carbs. And it did bring my energy back up from low blood pressure. But it's probably the worst type of like super high carb dinner, but I did it on purpose and I slept fine and I had no digestive issues from it. And I feel great today. This is what my body needed. But normally my dinner is pretty reliably grass fed something and low inflammation veggies or a piece of fruit and sometimes some starch. And it's pretty reliable that way.
Now, okay, this is interesting. I want to get into this. Tell me what you think are low inflammation vegetables, because this is something that I've always appreciated. I think it's fun to have pieces of our ideas where there's disagreements, but I've always appreciated the fact that we actually both agree that some vegetables are not so great for humans, that not all plants are good for humans. So the fact that you're saying low inflammation vegetables, anyone that's heard my podcast will understand that term, but let's dive into that a little bit. Right. This is a good segue.
So Paul, I got to say, I have great respect for you because you're evolving what you do. Same thing that I do. And I went through we didn't call it carnivore back then, but when I was stress testing the Bulletproof Diet before I wrote that book, I went through a period of about 3 months of only eating animal stuff, like zero carbs. And it did have really bad effects on my sleep and on my gut permeability. Like I got leaky gut from it, and it was not a sustainable thing for me. So what I realized, you can do it, but then you kind of go in and out. And for years, I've been tracking down what vegetables are inflammatory. It turns out different people have different kryptonite vegetables in my understanding of things. So the big categories of plant compounds that cause troubles, and this is like chapter one of the Bulletproof Diet. I'm like, I don't know which of these will be yours, but I can tell you which ones don't have any of those. So or at least don't have any that affect most people. So lectins obviously are an issue. I know I'm nightshade sensitive. Most lectins affect me. I'm very sensitive to oxalic acid, probably because I was a dumbass raw vegan for a while. That increased my levels dramatically. So for me, plants that have oxalates are a problem. Red raspberries, like, they're kind of good for you on lots of things, but if you can't process ellagic acid and you have an issue with oxalates, red raspberries and blackberries are high oxalate, but blueberries aren't. So blueberries would be great, but they're, you know, plant-based, but they're not a vegetable. When it comes to vegetables, you have to find out based on what works for your biology. One thing that works well for most people is cucumbers, especially if you peel them and you seed them and maybe even ferment them if you want to. So that's an example of something that's low, unless you're genetically sensitive to the lectins present in cucumbers, which most people aren't. Right. So like, are they a good guy or a bad guy? In my nomenclature, they're a suspect food, which means you have to go without them and probably most of the other plants for a while and go carnivore for a week or two. Oh, look, I don't have eczema. Everything feels better. Let me eat a bunch of tomatoes. And the next day, like, what just punched me in the knee? Well, that was the tomatoes. Those are on your list of guilty foods.
Right.
And what most people do is they're always eating, you know, 10 different things, and at least four of them are causing troubles. And they get rid of one and nothing changes, so they think it's innocent. The algorithm is get rid of everything except for meat. Do that for a little while, get your baseline. But if you never eat carbs, I think you're going to have issues with leaky gut. And I've not had a problem with small amounts of sugar for a long time if you're metabolically healthy.
Right.
So I've been, I think that honey is, especially raw honey, is better than things like maple syrup or coconut sugar, but I'll do those. And this is going to sound crazy. White cane sugar in a dark chocolate bar, okay, I have 5 grams of that stuff. We can metabolize sugar if things work. It's just, you don't want a lot of it. You don't want a lot of fructose. I also, and this isn't exactly a low inflammation plant, but I'll do something like trehalose. I do a reasonable amount of that, which is a special kind of sugar that is found in plants, but not in meaningful enough amounts. When you concentrate it, use it as a sweetener, it drives hydration in cells almost like creatine does. And it's really good for you, unless you have Clostridium, but that's a different story.
So this is interesting. So you touched on lectins. So I've talked about that in the past. These are carbohydrate binding proteins predominantly found in things like nuts and seeds and grains and beans. But the nightshade vegetables or the nightshade plants like tomatoes, eggplants, tend to have lectins that are problematic for a lot of people in their skin and their seeds. You mentioned cucumbers. Cucumbers are a fruit from like Cucurbitaceae family type of thing.
Fruit. That's true.
Yeah, but you can get rid of the skin and the seeds. Yeah, yeah. But I think it is. And then the other thing that I saw in your book, which is out now called Smarter, Not Harder. We're going to talk more about that, is phytic acid. And I was stoked that you mentioned phytic acid because sometimes on social media, when I talk about phytic acid, others in the nutrition space clap back and say, phytic acid isn't a big deal. But in your book, you mentioned it as like the number one thief of nutrients and energy. And I thought, yeah, there's a lot of phytic acid in foods that we eat and people aren't aware of how problematic this is.
It's a problem because in that first chapter of the Bulletproof Diet, I talked about lectins, phytic acid, omega-6 fats, oxalates, and then histamines and mycotoxins. And those are mostly storage toxins from plants or meat. Like it turns out ground beef and histamine is an issue for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So these are like foodborne things that can cause but may not cause issues for you. It doesn't mean they're always good for you, but if you have the bacteria that eats oxalate, you can probably benefit from the raspberries that would give me, actually they'd make me have to pee really bad. That's the first sign of oxalates for me. You need to kind of dial it in. In terms of plants that I'm willing to eat, I don't have an issue with carrots. I think that whether they're raw or cooked, that they're generally, you get more benefits than downside for carrots, but it depends on the person. I also think that celery for most people and fennel is absolutely manageable and you don't want to eat huge amounts of it. It doesn't seem to cause trouble for a lot of people, but it can for some people. And most of the lettuce family, the toxins in lettuce are just not a big issue. And you'll know if they are, eat a bunch of lettuce. And if it comes out whole, then maybe you should eat less lettuce. But if you have functioning digestion, you know, you might be okay with lettuce. I don't eat a huge amount of vegetables. I'm also just fine with broccoli and cauliflower. I think most people handle those reasonably well. And if you don't, you'll know it. Mm-hmm. And spinach and kale, I've decided I actually use them intravenously now because they're so good for you. I heard it on a vegan show.
He's joking. You do not do intravenous spinach, Dave Asprey. So many oxalates in spinach. So spinach and kale, not a fan.
Those are, people actually, they're like, Dave, you're too angry about kale. I'm like, guys, I'm not angry about kale. I'm just making fun of it because it's so absurd that we're trying to eat this garnish. And I say this as a raw vegan who juiced more kale and spinach than most people. And I got oxalate toxicity from doing this. It is not good for you. So I would say you and I are aligned about like 90% on where you've ended up with carnivore and where I ended up with Bulletproof. And it's that messy middle where I think the pros and cons for each of those plants in the middle, they're different for different people. And just because you can eat it doesn't mean you should. And for human survival, we evolved to be able to survive on all sorts of suboptimal foods. And it just makes me mad when marketing companies try to tell you that a survival peasant food like oatmeal that's full of phytic acid that steals your minerals, that that's somehow good for you. The tricky thing about phytic acid, the reason I wrote about it in Smarter, Not Harder, is that you will feel lectins if you're sensitive. You will feel histamine. These are immediate feedback. But with phytic acid, you get the feedback when you break your hip. Like you won't see the bone density. And you and I have both talked on social about bone density in vegans. And you can see the effects of phytic acid because the inner parts of their bones are like spongy. And I just had bone surgery last year and I was awake for it on my foot. They were cutting through the main bone in my foot because of an old yoga injury and a genetic, I have square joints. Anyhow, they needed to rebuild the joint in my right big toe. So when he was cutting, the saw goes, and the surgeon looks over at the nurse and goes, "What is going on? I'm having a hard time getting through the bone. Is this guy even human?" I'm like, "No, I don't eat phytic acid in meaningful amounts." And for listeners, like phytic acid, it's a problem. And when a doctor tells you it's not a problem, it's so ill-informed, because what you do to learn about things like mycotoxins, things like endocrine disruptors, things like phytic acid is you go to the farmers, the ranchers. And I mean, I've run a small farm with cows and pigs and sheep for several years in Canada. And what farmers do is they measure the amount of phytic acid in food, and they're feeding this to animals with three stomachs who actually can make phytase, which breaks down phytic acid. Humans don't make phytase in any meaningful amounts. Even if we eat tons of it, we make a tiny, tiny bit. So they still overload cows with it to the point they're adding enzymes into the food so the cows can handle even more of these phytic acid-rich foods than they're supposed to. Plants make phytic acid to steal our minerals, so we won't eat the plants. And if we do, we'll get weak, we won't reproduce, and then the plants can win. So,
or at least we'll stop eating them.
Yeah, you're eating oatmeal and you think it's good for you. It's peasant food to keep you from starving to death until you can kill something and eat it. That's what it's for. And it's for the ruling class to feed the peasants, because it doesn't matter if they die as long as they have lots of kids. Like, that's oatmeal and oat milk. Good God. So I just want people to understand, you're weak right now. You don't get results from your exercise. You don't get results from your meditation if you don't have minerals to make enzymes that allow your body to do its job. And that creates stress, which is why vegans are universally angry.
They are, Dave. They are. They're just cranky people.
I was a vegan. Okay, guys. I actually love vegans, because in terms of wanting to reduce animal suffering, I'm with you. In terms of wanting to fix the environment, I'm with you. And in terms of wanting to be healthy, I'm with you. It's just that the vegan diet doesn't do any of those things. We were deceived.
Exactly. The vegan diet ends up with people being nutrient deficient, creating more carbon in the environment through monocrop agriculture and more pesticides and more loss of life because of bi-kills. And then people are just not that great to each other and more life forms suffer. So it's just a great irony.
It turns out in the world, when you're looking at complex behavior emerging from distributed systems, there is a very nefarious, it's called an equilibrium. And if you're optimizing a system for a certain outcome, telling people to do something to solve a problem that creates the problem is the way to make the most money. And this is diet soda. Like, "Oh guys, yeah, you're fat, drink diet soda. It'll help you get thin." And it just keeps you fat. So you just drink diet soda for the rest of your life. If diet soda worked after 6 weeks, you drank it and you lost all your weight, and then you went back to regular soda, it would be a failed product. And so the vegan diet's one of those things. You know, the problem is you're just not vegan enough, because you felt good at first when you did it, right? So just have some more kale. And like, you'll do it for the rest of your life. Kale on a per calorie basis is 5 times more expensive than grass-fed Wagyu tenderloin. It's dumb.
Yeah. And ultimately, and if you could make that calculation based on nutrients, I wish someone could do, this would be interesting, it's probably already been done, some sort of a calculator with an adjustment factor for actual nutrient bioavailability in most vegan foods versus animal foods. You would see how expensive a vegan diet is. Like, what 100 milligrams of bioavailable magnesium costs you on a vegan diet versus on an animal-rich, animal-based diet. There's no comparison because of the bioavailability. And of course, magnesium is a divalent cation, meaning it has a +2 positive charge, and is also one of these minerals that gets bound up, chelated, bit into by phytic acid and pulled out of the body. So it's all wrapped into this conversation.
Here's an analogy that might be helpful. So I've been working, as I've been talking about Smarter Not Harder and just helping to socialize the book so people understand what they get when they read it. Nutrient availability is an abstract concept, but heroin availability isn't. We've all seen the movies where someone swallows condoms full of heroin to smuggle them through the border. Now, they ate 2 pounds of heroin, which should kill you, but magically it wasn't bioavailable, so it didn't kill them. Okay. When you eat plants, they basically have condoms wrapped around their minerals. You will not get those minerals.
And sometimes the plants are full of condoms that can wrap around other minerals in the other foods you're eating. So if you're eating a steak with something that's high in phytic acid, the minerals in that steak might get bound up by the phytic acid in the plant foods.
Even if you take a mineral like a zinc supplement with phytic acid, you know, a handful of almonds with your zinc is probably a dumb idea.
So this is the reality for the listeners, is that if you are eating phytic acid rich foods, you are swallowing condoms. I want people to remember that. So stop swallowing condoms.
I hadn't gotten that far, but okay. All right.
Stop putting condoms in your mouth, guys. It's a horrible idea. Don't swallow them, right? Stop doing this.
So you like it raw?
Yeah, it's binding up minerals. It's a horrible idea. Nobody's like, it's just, they're horrible. Condoms are horrible things to swallow. Don't do it.
They're petroleum products.
Yeah. Obviously, the metaphor is getting a little bit long here, but you get the idea. So that's the problem. And I like what you said there, that you might feel lectins, you might feel isothiocyanates from kale blocking the absorption of iodine leading to thyroid issues, but you're not going to feel phytic acid until your hip joint breaks or your shin breaks. When I was in college, I lived on basically like noodles and oatmeal, and I thought I was doing a great thing. And actually, I would put milk in my oatmeal, so I had calcium in the oatmeal, and I had so many stress fractures at that time in my life. I was running a lot.
Yes.
Mistake number two was that I was doing chronic cardio, which we can get into, but I was running a ton and I had horrible stress fractures. This really, really stressed me out in college because I was addicted to running and the endorphins, it feels good. But my body could not handle the stress of long distance running or even moderate distance running. And I had stress fractures in my, the first bone I stress fractured was my femur, which is a big bone to stress fracture. And then I stress fractured my fibula. And then I think I had a tibial stress fracture.
Oh my God.
It was probably over the span of 3 or 4 years, but I persisted in my oatmeal love affair. And in my N of one anecdote, that was associated with multiple stress fractures that resolved almost immediately when I cut grains out of my diet and I was able to up my mileage and do more chronic cardio, which wasn't great for other reasons. But
yeah.
Anyway.
I love that we're talking about chronic cardio. I used to believe when I weighed that 300 pounds, just even in my late teens, early 20s, like I've got a Cannondale road bike, Specialized mountain bike. I would put in 20 miles a day and I would do lots of cardio in Albuquerque, and it just doesn't work. And I don't think I did myself any favors with that. And now with Smarter, Not Harder, like, okay, using AI technologies and all that, you can get 6 times better cardiovascular response from 5 minutes, 3 times a week of cardio using the algorithms that I'm talking about in the book, compared to an hour a day, 5 days a week. So you probably spend 5 minutes a day brushing your teeth, or sorry, 5 minutes or 15 minutes a week brushing your teeth. So you can get 6 times more cardio in the amount of time you spend brushing your teeth than you can from doing an hour a day. And there's university studies backing this up. And like, that's one of the dozens of different things I'm talking about in the book. It's like, look, I'm too busy to spend an hour a day doing cardio, right? And it doesn't work. But we have this algorithm in our minds that says, oh, if we work really hard, we'll get results. And the reality, do you have some friends who work really hard and they don't get results, Paul?
I know some people like that.
There is no correlation between working hard and getting results. There are people who do barely any work and they just magically get great results. There are some people who work really hard and never see any results. So maybe doing what works is better than working hard. Just saying.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that you kind of captured that in the title of your book, like, you know, work smarter, not harder, be intentional about what you're doing. I mean, I'm a victim of this, or I should say I was wrong in my estimation of this in the past. And I ran tons and tons of miles in the past. And now I sprint as I'm paddling out of the ocean, I sprint back to my car. And that's, you know, I'll sprint paddle in the ocean when I'm trying not to get killed by a wave or trying to catch a wave, and right, I'll sprint back to the car, but that's all the cardio I do. And, you know, that's what I feel much better doing that. I remember my days of, I was a cyclist, so I overtrained on the bike. I'm very thankful that my perineal artery still works after sitting on the bike seat for that much time.
I know, right?
Right. Yeah.
It's a useful artery.
That's a big important artery, especially for men, but for women too. And I overtrained. I remember being so overtrained as a cyclist, so overtrained as a runner, that I would just, when I wasn't running, all I would want to do was lay on the couch and watch movies and do like nothing productive with my life could happen. I had a girlfriend when I lived in Boulder, Colorado, and I wouldn't even go for walks with her because I didn't want to be on my feet because I was so overtrained from riding my bike 3 to 4 hours a day. And it was just all I could do when I would do distance running. When I used to be an ultra runner, I would go out on 20 mile runs on Sunday mornings and run for 3 or 4 hours and in the mountains. And you know, I'd come back and I would eat oatmeal and watch stupid movies. This is my life. What was I doing? And look, if you guys are listening to this and you really want to be an ultra runner, great. Just understand that it's maybe not so good for your life and your hormones and other productivity in your life. There are better ways to get cardiovascular fitness if that's what you desire.
That's the thing. And I have some friends who are like, yeah, but if I don't, you know, do my chronic cardio for an hour a day, I just get really stressed and anxious. I'm like, okay. There's a word for that. It's called addiction. And it's driven by opiates, and it's driven by the fact you're probably burning off excess adrenaline or excess cortisol because you're stressed. And you can be stressed because you have a nutrient deficiency problem. And you can be stressed because you're overtraining, or you can be stressed because you have a mean boss, actually, versus you just think your boss is mean because you're stressed in general from your body. And if you need to do chronic cardio every day to feel sane, you have an emotional problem. If you just love it, okay. I know addicts, and this may trigger some people, especially former addicts, but I'm just going to say it. They're like, but I like my drugs and I don't want to give them up. Okay. That is a choice, and it is okay to make your choice. And you might not be making it from a place of clear thinking and clear-headedness because you're on drugs, but it is your right to make that choice. And people who've been through a recovery process also know that until you hit rock bottom as an addict, it's oftentimes hard to see the need to go into recovery. So I'm just going to say it. If you are beating your body senseless over time, you're experiencing the stress fractures, you're doing all these things, and you're doing it because you think it's moral, you think it's good, or because you get a high from the endorphins from it, it's not a longevity strategy at all. It's not good for you. And I will go so far as to say, you could call it a form of self-harm. And I have done it. I did it because I believed it would work, and it did not work. And as an anti-aging expert, I don't recommend it. You need to move for 20 minutes a day. You need to do stuff you love. But if what you love is, you know, grinding out, you know, 20 mile runs at 3 times a week, it's not going to end well for you.
And to be fair, I spent a lot of time in the wilderness on those 20 mile runs and saw some really cool things and got into nature. It didn't end well for me.
If you'd have hiked, it would have ended well. It was the running that was the problem.
The running was the problem. Most people know this about me, but, before I was an ultra runner, I thru hiked the Pacific Crest Trail. So I walked from Mexico to Canada one summer, actually the summer of 2000, I believe it was. And I was able to walk 30 plus miles a day for 106 days in a row, with really not much strain on my body. So that was the Pacific Crest Trail. I walked 30 miles, 26 to 30 miles a day. It's a 2,700 mile trail. We hiked it.
That's healthy and life-changing, assuming you're not doing what most people do on the PCH, is they carry oatmeal and noodles.
Exactly. So it's
you got to not do that while you're walking. And for God's sake, powdered organs might be something to take with you. What do you think, Paul? Would that be a good idea?
People have sometimes asked me, and I think that like distance hiking is an interesting thing. If I could do it again, I would absolutely take desiccated organs like hardened soil. And you know what else I would do? I would take tallow. And I would take lots of dehydrated meat, and I would take honey for a carbohydrate and some dried fruit. And what the hilarious part of the PCT was that when I started, this is, again, anyone listening, this is 23 years ago in my life, I was a different human. I wanted to do it without meat because I had been programmed by the environment, by the matrix around us, to believe that doing it without meat would be better. And I made this porridge before the PCT, and I dehydrated a bunch of apples and fruit. And I was going to do the PCT as a vegan or vegetarian or something. And by the first resupply, which was, I think, 3 or 4 days into the trail, I went to the diner and bought a hamburger. And I'm sure it was not a grass-fed hamburger, but the rest of the trail, what I was doing was regretting the fact that the guy I was hiking the trail with, whose name was Broxton Bird, wherever you are, Broxton, miss you, buddy. he had brought jerky, and I just stole his jerky for the rest of the trail. The meat. So this is actually interesting, and it'll segue into a discussion about peanuts and peanut butter. So I thought that the foods that I never got sick of on the PCT, on the Pacific Crest Trail, were jerky, hamburgers, animal products like cheese and cream cheese. And that was about it. I got sick of peanut butter. So so many people, when I talk to them about peanut butter, so we'll take a little left-hand turn here and diverge into talking about peanut butter. They say peanut butter is the greatest thing. Well, I got so sick of peanut butter, and I never got sick of animal food. So I appreciated that in the book, you took a little poop on peanut butter, which is great because I hate peanuts and I want people to understand how bad these things are for you.
There's no argument other than I was starving and I needed to eat. I was starving. I mean, and I've said this for years. Okay, they're the number one source of aflatoxin, the most cancer-causing molecule we know of. Okay, it's in peanut butter, even good peanut butter, whatever. You can just go just have a nice sticker on it or something. And then a lot of people know about the lectins in peanuts, that those are a serious problem, and the phytic acid and things like that. But what a lot of people don't know about is something called VLCFA, which is very long chain fatty acids. And these are fatty acids that are so long, and they're actually saturated, but they're so long that your cell membrane, think of it as this thick, they don't fit. So they go in sideways, and they're overrepresented in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease. They're not good for you. Oh. So like, good God, there's not an argument for peanut butter. And they go, oh, it's high protein. It's like, no, actually it's not. And the protein in there isn't very good quality protein. You know what else is high protein? 100% gluten. It's protein, but maybe you should look at what the protein is, because sarin nerve gas is a plant-based protein. And maybe you don't want to eat that, right? So different proteins do different things. The plant-based proteins generally suck compared to animal-based proteins, and peanut proteins are not particularly good for you. There's not that much of it compared to the fat, which isn't very good for you. It's like, why is it good for you? I don't know.
I shudder to think about, I hope that my brain composition of my fatty acids and my cell membranes and my neurons and my glia in my brain has been turned over a little bit, and I don't have too many very long chain fatty acids in my brain. But I have this memory in my brain of coming back from school when I was a kid and making like the biggest, thickest peanut butter and jelly sandwich I'd ever made in my life. It was like an inch of peanut butter on bread. And my mom must not have seen me do this, because she would have just jumped in and said, you can't eat that much peanut butter. And I'm sure it was Skippy or Jif full of hydrogenated oils, you know, 30 years ago.
Those spread better. I mean, let's face it, the ones with oil on top aren't that
good. You don't want the oil on top. And I remember eating this and thinking, I don't feel so good. And I'm sure that I put some very long chain fatty acids in my brain with that, the worst peanut butter and the biggest peanut butter and jelly sandwich I'd ever made. I'm sorry I did that to myself. But yeah, peanut is not good for humans.
That thick layer.
Yeah.
I switched early on, back probably in the days of the Zone diet, you know, in Atkins time, I switched to almond butter, which is actually better than peanut butter. Of course, it's still high in lectins. They're just less aggressive lectins. They're still not so good. It's still high in phytic acid. There's that. It still has seed oils in it. There's that. And eating lots of that stuff, it's also very high in oxalates, which as a raw vegan, well, got to have some fat in there, on some coconut oil and a few spoons full of, might as well have some more almonds, some almond oil. And man, people are going to say, but Dave, you should have sprouted it. Dude, I did. I was a raw vegan. I had this little sprouting chamber in my kitchen and juicers, all the things that repel women. I had all those in my kitchen.
When I was a raw vegan, one of my friends made me a rack for sprouting. I sprouted like wheatgrass. I sprouted barley. And I remember I had a grinder. I had a wheatgrass juice maker.
Yeah, those little...
a metal wheatgrass grinder in my kitchen. And I remember I had a raw vegan phase. This is probably isn't news to anyone that listens to this podcast. It was about 6 months long. It definitely caused at least one breakup in my relationship of a woman who thought I was crazy. And I was. That woman is good. I'm glad she broke up with me. And then absolutely after that, another girl did not go out with me because I was too skinny. And that girl is amazing. I have no idea what her name was, but wherever she is, thank you. Because that was part of the impetus that got me eating meat and animal foods again. It was my reproductive brain going, dude, you are never going to have sex again if you don't eat some other foods besides vegan foods. And believe me, that's quite motivating for anyone who's a human. But I was wheatgrass juicing one day and I would do it before I went for a run, and it was fine. It was fine. It was fine. And then one day it just got to be like, I was so nauseated by the alkaloids, like just the plant defense chemicals, the alkaloids in wheatgrass just got to me. And I will never have another shot of wheatgrass in my life. It was just, I was traumatized by wheatgrass. I have wheatgrass PTSD, Dave, because it just hit me like I just ran into a wall because there were so many of this alkaloid in the wheatgrass, and my body was finally just broke through. My body was my own intervention saying, stop drinking wheatgrass juice, you moron. It was a good day after a lot of bad days. So, but I want people to understand that there's a theme here, which is that peanuts are beans, right? Beans are high in lectins. Beans are a seed. This is also going to have more of the phytic acid, of the defense chemicals, yeah, of the oxalates. So I want people to understand that like we're focusing on a few different foods, but this is, I think, a reason that both Dave and I are not fans of grains, nuts, beans, and legumes, generally speaking. If there are some that you're more of a fan of, you're welcome to chime in, Dave. But I think that those are really best left out of people's diets. There are some that are less problematic than others. But
you know, I think we need to be a little bit fair. If the people actually have food insecurity, these belong in their diets before ramen.
Okay. You mean financial food insecurity or something?
Yeah, financial food insecurity, or maybe in a part of the world where there's actually food insecurity. So if you're in a situation like that, I would rather see wheat, peanut butter, and almond butter than fat-free ramen and canola oil.
Fair.
Okay. So, and that's the idea. It's the mislabeling of these as superfoods that ignores toxins and ignores nutrient availability. In fact, there's this kind of evil sort of math called ANDI, the Aggregate Nutrient Density Index score. This is the biggest farce ever, and it's used to justify selling 50 calories worth of some sort of leafy green whatever. It's not very much food, and it's $6 because it's high in nutrients. To calculate aggregate nutrient density index, you ignore the volume of the food, you ignore the water of the food, you ignore the weight of the food, and you just look at the number of calories in the food. So what they want you to eat is food that has nothing in it but vitamins. I'm like, there's a name for that. It's called supplements. But those don't count.
It's a calorie per nutrient.
Yeah.
Metric that ignores bioavailability, that ignores other toxins or anti-nutrients in the foods, and it puts kale at the top or things that are not super great for humans. I think that if you look at humans, if you look at the natural experiments, it's quite clear that organs and meat are really, in my opinion, and chime in if you agree, the only things that can be labeled superfoods. And because of this strange socio-political climate that we live in, like they can't be labeled superfoods because everyone thinks that they're bad for the environment and there's a carbon conspiracy now. I don't know. Like these foods will never be known as superfoods when they actually are. Like those are the foods that I consistently see giving people life and vitality. If you have them in your diet, you're more vital than if you have them out of your diet. It's very hard to ignore.
You know, I don't think that's fair to say that only animal foods can be superfoods, Paul. Because it's entirely possible to take plants and use modern technology to remove all of the plant toxins and to remove all of the parts of the plant you don't want to eat. And what's left is called the supplement industry. And so supplements are also superfoods, just like animal products, right? So it's not that everything that comes from a plant, and also everything that comes from petroleum is not bad for you, right? Yeah, it's possible to torture petroleum enough until it becomes a chemical, and then to use the chemical as part of a process of making, say, an amino acid, right? So as long as there's no impurities from the petroleum, if it's 100% pure amino acid, okay, it's bioidentical. It's actually useful at that point.
Yeah.
And so the idea of there being a superfood, dude, let me just lay it out there. The notion of a superfood was a marketing thing for someone who's trying to sell you beans or some other crap. Like, what is a superfood? What is the definition? And by the way, there's one other thing. If you were to just say foods that reduce all-cause mortality, that is a plant-based superfood. You want to know what it is? What?
I don't even see you right now. My screen blacked out. We're having technical difficulties.
That was your CTSD, coffee, traumatic stress disorder.
So we have to do a whole podcast.
You could argue
there's going to be a whole podcast on coffee, Dave.
You could argue that coffee, there's just hundreds of studies of mitochondrial enhancement. There's hundreds of studies showing reduction of all-cause mortality, things like cancer, things like diabetes, things like bone density. So,
what about, I don't know. What about this word that you had earlier, the addict word, Dave?
Let's talk about addiction here. So if there was something, Paul, that you had to do every day, and if you don't do it, you feel really bad, especially after like 3 days, you feel terrible. Are you addicted to it?
Well, I mean, there's physiologic definitions of addiction and psychological definitions of addiction. So I think I think that my point with coffee is that the dopaminergic response from caffeine is so strong that it reinforces the behavior in a way that is very difficult for humans to change. And I worry a little bit about that.
Like, because if sleep is, you're addicted to sleep, but the same way you're addicted to coffee.
This is
you do it every day, you live longer and you feel better. And if you stop doing it, life is worse. So, I mean,
okay, it's good that you bring up sleep because this is a problem that I've always had with coffee and caffeine specifically, as he downs the rest of his beef coffee. That was actually, Dave is not drinking coffee on this podcast because that would be incongruous. That's beef blood. It's liver juice.
It was coffee. It was my danger coffee. It's reinforced with trace minerals too. So it's overcoming any arguments you might have about trace phytic acid in coffee, which I know you were going to say.
No, I was going to say, this is the other thing I worry about with caffeine is that the quarter life of caffeine is 12 hours. And so I worry that when people are drinking coffee or caffeinated beverages of any type within 12 hours of their sleep, they're still having 12 or, you know, at least 25%. Of the caffeine in their body physiologically. And wouldn't that affect sleep metrics and like sleep architecture? And that's if somebody drinks coffee, the last drink 12 hours before they go to sleep. What if they drink coffee like 6 hours before they go to sleep or 8 hours before they have even more? So quarter life means, you know, a quarter of the caffeine still in your system 12 hours later. Everyone's going to have slightly different pharmacokinetics for caffeine, but that's generally true for most people.
Well, it's a bell curve. There are people who can't have any coffee or chocolate or anything like green tea.
Right.
And they don't do well because they are slow caffeine metabolizers. And there are some people who really can have coffee right before bed and they just process the stuff like it doesn't exist and they get good quality sleep. They're very rare on either end. Some people have to stop at 10 a.m. or noon. Most people by 2 o'clock, if they stop, their sleep is unaffected by low levels of coffee. And so, you've got to know which one you are. And I'm pretty strict about not drinking coffee after 2 o'clock. It's 1:50 and I just have my last
1:59. You mentioned something earlier that I wanted to circle back on. And then I want to talk more about the exercise stuff. You said, because I know people might ask about this and it may be something we can dive into, or maybe we just clarify it for people. You said you don't want to eat too much fructose. This is something that I've been thinking about and looking at the research, and I've found a lot of discordance in the research. I haven't found a lot of research to suggest that fruit or honey is harmful for humans, even in pretty significant quantities. But I do see a lot to suggest that high fructose corn syrup, which is a different animal, is harmful for humans. So are you aware of like what makes you say you don't want to eat too much fructose? Is there more clarification there, or is there something that dive into? Okay, yeah.
And it's something that even honey and fruit do. Mm-hmm. So when you're getting more fructose, as fructose circulates in the body, it does, even from fruit, it increases fatty liver. It also increases advanced glycation end products because fructose does that when it's in the body. So what I've recommended for people is have less than 25 grams of fructose per day to minimize that problem. 25 grams of fructose is a pretty meaningful amount. That's 50 grams of table sugar because that's half glucose and half fructose. Mm-hmm. So that's a meaningful amount. You can have, you know, a couple of pieces of fruit. You can have a meaningful amount of honey or maple syrup or coconut sugar or something. And that's primarily because AGEs or advanced glycation end products form when fructose or other sugars, but more easily with fructose, when it binds permanently to a protein and then makes free radicals. And this is one of the contributors to aging. You get extracellular junk is what I call it in my anti-aging book. So I'm not saying you need to be afraid of having some fructose, but a higher fructose diet, whether it's corn syrup or not, does change even the amount of LDL. I don't really care about LDL for the most part. But what's more interesting and more important is a high fruit diet. Say you're going to be fruitarian, your triglycerides spike dramatically. You live in a different world because number one, you're right on the equator. So you get sunshine a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. The more sunshine you get, the more fructose you can handle. And the more exercise you get, the more fructose you can handle. So you're surfing in the sun for 2 hours a day. I could see you doing 50 grams of fructose a day without getting the problems that most people are going to get at 25.
Hmm. You know, maybe you can send me the studies offline. I'm not aware of any studies in humans that show that fruit contributes to NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. There was one study out of Iran that I saw, and I had some conversation about Ken Berry about this. And if you look at the methods of that study, people can go back and look at the previous podcast where I've talked about this. That it was observational, and I believe they correlated increased consumption of fruit with worsening of people that had pre-existing NAFLD. But when you looked at the methods, they said fruit was fruit, dried fruit, and like some like fruit products. And so I'm thinking, wait, what? Okay, dried fruit is not always going to be pure fruit. It could have additives. And then fruit products are like, are you talking like peaches in a can? It just gets to be very sticky. Bad pun. It gets to be very confusing in nutritional science. And so the methods of that paper, I thought, were kind of sketchy because, you know, basically what I see mostly, and I've never seen a solid human study that suggests that fruit consumption causes worsening of NAFLD. And I look at my lab.
I want to see the blood work of 10 fruitarians if you can still find ones that are healthy enough to get blood work done.
But then we have the confounding issue of like, well, they're not eating meat, right? So I know what my blood work looks like. I just got a set last week when I was in Austin. I've done it, I think, 3 times in the last 6 months. And you know, my liver enzymes are fine. I don't have fatty liver by any blood work.
Do you know the percentage of fat in your liver?
I haven't done an ultrasound.
So I did, and it was one of the lowest they'd ever seen. It was under 1%.
Uh huh.
So it's one of those things.
Did you do an ultrasound?
This was all
biopsy.
Pre-nuvo, the whole body MRI.
I could do it. I would be willing to put some wager ribeyes. I don't have much fat in my liver, but yeah, I'd be curious.
Yeah, I believe I would bet you have more than I do, but you do exercise way more than I do. I just exercise better than you do because I wrote Smarter Not Harder.
But then it's also important, I think, to note that, like, you know, there's studies in diabetics where they give diabetics. So, and I also haven't seen any studies in humans to suggest that honey worsens NAFLD or really any significant metrics. They gave diabetics like an increasing amount of honey. And I think in the last 2 weeks of an 8-week trial, they gave them 125 or 150 grams of honey per day. And the diabetic group saw lower blood glucose and lower metrics of insulin resistance, lower fasting insulin. So that was really striking to me that you can give people, diabetics, 125 grams of honey, and their insulin sensitivity gets better. So when I just think it's important to like kind of have these conversations and drill down a little bit on fructose. I don't fear it as much as many people do, but I'm open to the literature if there's some out there in humans that I'm not aware of. I just haven't seen it.
I don't know how fructose from fruit magically doesn't cause advanced glycation end products when fructose from any source does that. And the lack of a study in humans, if it does it in other mammals,
glucose causes advanced glycation end products in humans too, but we don't worry about glucose.
Not as much as fructose, though. Fructose is way more attractive to the proteins.
Right. And I think that there's some confusion about whether A1C actually represents fructose glycation. There was some debate in the community about this, and I was able to pretty easily find a clear study in mice, and we might imagine that the chemistry, the organic chemistry of glycation involving fructose and a hemoglobin molecule is pretty similar in a mouse as it is a human. when they fed mice more fructose, they clearly saw more glycation that was reflected in the hemoglobin A1C. The ketogenic community had some concerns that fructose was causing unseen glycation. And my counterpoint was, no, I think you would see it. So you would see your hemoglobin A1C rise. I mean, that's the best metric that I'm aware of for glycation is like, what is your hemoglobin A1C, which is in general kind of a poor metric of I think, you know, average blood sugar. But I do think that there's good evidence that A1C will show fructose glycation.
So is your A1C really low on a high fructose diet?
It's pretty low. It's 5.2.
Say that again. You said 5.2?
5.2, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Pretty low. Not crazy low, but I'm not sure. I mean, we have this thing that human brains do to save electricity. Instead of thinking through things, we'll do cognitive shortcuts that are kind of like having a graphics card in your computer because it's better to specialize. So we make all these shortcuts we just believe to be true. And one of them we mentioned earlier, you know, hard work gets results. No, but if something is bad, none of it is better. And if something is good, more of it is better. And those are just provably false, but we just intuitively believe that. So we change our behavior that way. I'm not certain that having an A1C of 3.0 is good for you. It's probably disordered.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what your A1C is?
It is, last time I looked, I think it was 5.1, 5.2. Shoot, I don't have that lab work with, but it was right near where yours is.
Yeah.
I've had enough of them done and they're usually like low fives.
Yeah. I didn't see. I mean, it would be an interesting thing because that would be an interesting point to sort of look at in the literature and understand for people. Like, is there a level at which you wouldn't want to have more fructose than this because you will cause increased glycation and that's problematic? It's just,
There probably is. I mean, one of the things I used to do a while ago was I would take straight glucose or straight dextrose, which is basically corn glucose.
Yeah.
Right. Because if you were going to have some carbs, you can have fructose free sugar.
Right.
Right. And if you do that, your body burns it more effectively and it doesn't have the triglyceride problem that fructose has. So that was something. In fact, if you're getting a migraine and you do, I don't know, it's almost like caffeine is made for migraines. But if you were to have a cup of Danger coffee, say espresso, and you were to put a tablespoon of straight glucose in it instead of raw honey, right? And then you were to pop it with an aspirin and do that and watch your migraine just dissolve. And it's not that it's treating or curing a migraine or anything like that. It's just that caffeine and aspirin together are one of the most effective things to treat a migraine. And having additional glucose for the parts of your brain, not the neurons, but the glial cells, and for your mitochondria to have a big boost, that works really, really well.
Yeah, there's a lot about migraines. That might be a good segue to seed oils in a moment. Migraines migraines are one of the most food responsive things in medicine that I'm aware of. So much food sensitivity is connected with migraines. So if you're getting migraines, definitely think about foods that can be triggering those for you. You know, it's interesting because the Ray Peak community, I've had Georgi Dinkov on my podcast a couple of times. The Ray Peak community is actually quite excited about fructose. And
I love those guys. Even back 20 years ago when I ran the anti-aging nonprofit group in Silicon Valley, we talk about Ray Peak, but I mean, this is a guy who will tell you cottage cheese and a can of Coke is a great breakfast. It's like there's interesting thinking and then there's like, what the hell? And it, you know, if you try that stuff, I see people kind of go down the rat hole there. It feels like a little bit orthorexic, but his idea of mitochondria being important is absolutely true. I have to make sure I get enough fructose every day to be healthy. Man, I have a hard time.
Georgie's pointed out some interesting stuff to me about benefits of fructose involving, you know, kind of helping to balance phosphate in the human diet. They pointed out the importance of the calcium phosphorus ratio, which is something that I don't think a lot of people think about. We're eating meat without getting enough calcium from milk. That appears to affect things negatively. You can check your parathyroid hormone if you're not sure if you're getting enough calcium. But I'll talk more in the next podcast next week, guys, with Georgie about the calcium phosphorus ratio. But fructose does seem to have benefits from a phosphorus perspective in the human diet. I'll just say this. When Ray recommends Coke and cottage cheese, I think like, well, I'm not going to drink Coke, but he's recommending like a Mexican Coke that has sucrose and not high fructose corn syrup. I don't think Coke is great because of the caramel color. And Ray, I mean, the Ray Pete folks have also pointed out, you know, the importance of being aware of caramel color. But I think that they're, one of the things that I think that they would say that, like, this is something that anyone could do anywhere in the world and that they are not afraid of sucrose, which is something that, again, I've talked with Georgie about. And I don't see the point in consuming sucrose because then you're getting calories with no micronutrients. I'd rather get...
Oh, come on. You just dropped into the Andy world right there. It doesn't matter. You're not getting micronutrients from brown sugar or from honey. There's not meaningful amounts of them in there, Paul. You're getting sugar. It's for fuel. If you want micronutrients, take a fucking vitamin or eat some liver. Come on.
Well, I'm thinking like fruit juice, Dave, like orange juice, right? I'm going to get
thymine. Oh, there's so much vitamin C in there.
Oh, thymine. Great. There's a good amount of thymine in orange juice and other nutrients.
Compared to the thymine that I took, in fact, the benfotiamine that I took this morning, the fast soluble form that works way better, that had hundreds of times more than your stupid orange juice. Yeah, Paul.
But why not get it from food, Dave?
I'm just trolling you right now.
I know you are. You're super trolling me. But I did eat liver this morning. I had some raw liver and some desiccated organs. So,
Did you blend it with orange juice? I just have to know.
I could. I'll try that tomorrow. That would be like
a... I did try that once. The first time I ever had raw liver was actually before I did the raw vegan thing. And I'd read about this. God, this had to be like 2005. And I bought a raw lamb's liver at the farmer's market. I threw it in my, one of those upside down blenders, Nutribullet.
Yeah.
With some orange juice, because I had to hide the flavor somehow, and I blended it up. Nutribullets can't do liver well enough. So I'm trying to drink it. You know, those strings in the liver?
Oh, yeah.
It gets caught on my tooth, and there's like liver hanging down my throat and orange juice liver stuff. Oh, dude, it's not good. But I'm going to stick with the powdered stuff. Thanks for making it.
You can do desiccated organs, or you could just, you could take a little bit of liver and just put it in a little smoothie. Who knows? You could probably hide it there. We talked about seed oils a little bit. I wanted to circle back because the seed oil debate rages online. People cite studies from 2019. There was a Twitter thread about a study from 2019, which was a cohort study of 30. I think it was a meta-analysis of 30 cohort studies with a couple of RCTs in there, but mostly cohort studies looking at levels of linoleic acid in the human body. And they had the more linoleic acid in the human body was correlated with better cardiovascular outcomes. And it really caught fire on Twitter with people saying like, facts are facts. And I just thought it was so crazy. And it brings up the importance of, it's just nutrition research is so hard. And I've talked about this on the previous podcast with Tucker Goodrich. If anyone is down the seed oil rabbit hole far, they'll know that blood levels of linoleic acid are not a very good indicator of consumption of linoleic acid, which is this omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acid found in seed oils. And if you look at those 30 cohort studies in this trial, this meta-analysis that was being touted on Twitter as proof that seed oils are not bad for humans, only three of them looked at adipose tissue levels. And adipose tissue levels of linoleic acid is really the only way that, it's the only metric we have that's an accurate representation of the consumption what would you say?
Cell membrane levels, not just RBC levels. Tissue levels are important.
But it's hard to measure cell membrane. People will do RBC.
Oh, it's hard, but it's a good measure.
Yeah, so adipose. But only three of the 30 were adipose tissue.
Yeah.
And if you look at those three studies, there's really no correlation. There's nothing to suggest that higher levels of linoleic acid in the fat tissue leads to better cardiovascular health. And there's actually some studies that suggest higher levels of linoleic acid in the adipose tissue, one of the better metrics for actually correlating linoleic acid consumption from seed oils, is worse cardiovascular health. But it's just, anyway, how do you feel about seed oils, Dave? Thanks for letting me get that in there. Had to get that anti-Twitter dig.
You know, you're so welcome. And did you read Superhuman? That was my big anti-aging book.
I think I read it. It was a while ago. Yeah.
Good deal. It had a lot of new stuff about where fat goes in the body. And I found one or two studies, and they were probably mouse studies, but there might have been a human in there. Just, I don't know, this is a 5 year ago book,
right?
References, so forgive me. But they, it turns out when you eat an oil, you can see where is it going to go in the membranes in the brain versus the membranes in a muscle versus the heart versus different organs and different systems in the body. So consumption of seed oil, there's no guarantee it's going to like fill you evenly with that oil, including especially in your blood, which is what you're talking about. But the part of the body that was most susceptible, number one, was white adipose tissue. So your love handles will tell you whether you've been eating a lot of seed oils because it goes there first. And the second part is the portion of the brain that's either omega-6 or omega-3. The brain is 45% saturated fat, and it is pegged hard. Your body will take fat from anywhere and make palmitic acid because you have to have 45% saturated or the brain doesn't work. And then above that, the other 55% is a mix of 3 and 6. And when you eat omega-6s, the ratio of 6 to 3 changes dramatically. Right. There's some monounsaturated as well. So what you want to do is primarily mono, actually primarily saturated with some mono, but not too much. And then a very small amount of polyunsaturated oils, about 1.6%, which is what you find in grass-fed beef. More than that is unnecessary, although they are necessary because you have to have that much. Seed oils in general, they're bad for you, except you'll love this one, black cumin seed oil.
Okay.
There's
why is
a
that
great argument. You what?
Why is that one good for you?
Because it stabilizes mast cell membranes. So for people with allergy problems or people with long COVID, black seed oil used medicinally, you take a teaspoon of that, it actually meaningfully in studies reduces systemic inflammation. So you can use some seeds as actually medicine.
Right.
Right. And that's okay. But seed oils in general as food, it's terrifying and it's unnecessary. One of the companies I'm really excited about, I'm an investor in. It's called Zero Acre Farms. Have you seen those guys?
Yeah, I had those guys on my podcast.
You did? Beautiful. Okay. So they just announced, this is one of my most exciting portfolio companies. They just announced that Chipotle invested
this.
In them.
This is very cool.
It's going to be cooking in monounsaturated fats, which last longer and are much healthier. Now, I've been encouraging them, guys, you can make any fat you want from fermentation now. Why don't you just make the equivalent of tallow that has more saturates like stearic acid so that would accelerate our metabolism? And they're like, the market doesn't demand it. So, Paul, it's your job and my job and many others to actually create demand for saturated fats so that then we can build the products that restaurants will want to use and people want to buy.
Yeah. So people can find them at zeroacre.com. I had Tucker Goodrich and Jeff Knobs on the podcast a little while ago. It was a really solid deep dive on seed oils, guys. They have an amazing blog with some like very detailed white papers, quote unquote, on why seed oils might be causing obesity and cardiovascular.
Might be.
What's that? Yeah. Well, they have to count, you know, we're trying to be some discussion. Instagram is censoring me now when I talk about seed oils, Dave. So the majority of the posts I've done recently where I say seed oils are harmful for humans and I reference studies showing that they increase oxidized LDL and Lp(a) and things like this, which are clearly problematic from a cardiovascular disease perspective, get labeled as partly false misinformation. So we're running into a real problem in the health space now that dissenting voices in anything nutrition are being cut down. And actually, this is very timely. I'm probably going to do a whole post about this soon. I had a post where I talked about Kellogg's cornflakes being used as anti-masturbation tools, which is the actual...
Oh, me too. I talk about this a lot.
It's the actual history of Kellogg's cornflakes. It's not really... It's like written in textbooks. And John Harvey Kellogg, a prominent Seventh-day Adventist and anti-libido. And the post got taken down for false information saying that Kellogg's cornflakes were not made to kill libido. So at this point, the fact checkers are getting just brazen. And I don't know who's fact-checking the fact-checkers, but it's pretty wild. Wow. Anyway, that was a digression.
You know what to do? I do this sometimes. I just add the label for them ahead of time. Like when you're doing the post, you can just add it on the bottom so they don't have to go to the trouble.
But the problem is
just
that...
Just try it. Any post that has that at the bottom is 10 times more interesting because it must be true. And everyone listening to your podcast knows this.
Well,
so anytime something is worth censoring, people want to read it.
The problem is that Instagram, the algorithm stops promoting your post once it's labeled as partly false information. And so I've had a number of posts with a lot of engagement, over 1 million views in a day. And then they hit a ceiling because Instagram won't promote those posts about canola oil and problems with, you know, seed oils. And we did a post with Chipotle, interestingly. So this is wrapping back into the seed oil conversation with Chipotle. So Chipotle traditionally has cooked in rice bran oil. I actually went to a Chipotle and asked them, oil, I think is maybe 30-ish percent linoleic acid. So it's a seed oil. It's a bran, but rice is a seed. It's a grain. And so I talked about the amount of rice you would have to eat to get the equivalent of 3 tablespoons now, not teaspoons, of rice bran oil, which is what's in like a regular serving of Chipotle is like 2 to 3 tablespoons of rice bran oil. And you'd have to eat 24 cups of rice to get this, which is absurd. No one would ever have... And the point is just that evolutionarily, we'd never have this much consumption of seed oils. And that post got censored as partly false misinformation, Dave. So it went to over 1 million, 1.2, 1.4 in a day. And then Instagram throttles it and people don't see the information that's valuable is the problem here.
Mm.
Crazy stuff.
I don't even know what to do about Instagram. Maybe the Twitter files will tell us the same things happening at Instagram. You know, it is.
It's a strange world. And it's just, I don't know what we do. I mean, this is the value of podcasts. This is the value of longer form conversations because these are not censored in the same way. They might be on YouTube.
They will be. You know it's coming.
It is coming. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
But Dave, I know you have a time constraint now.
Yeah, I got to run.
Thank you for your time, my friend.
You're welcome. And guys, new book, Smarter, Not Harder. It's actually about all the stuff you can do to save a ton of time on exercise. And the two things that are most important for any exercise or any meditation to work better, it's kind of straightforward. It is, you got to have your minerals, you got to have your fat-soluble vitamins that come from animals, and then do the stuff that works better. So Smarter, Not Harder, read the book. If you like Paul's work, you probably will like mine. We don't always believe the same things.
That's good.
We're both science-backed. And this is stuff that makes the quality of life you have way better.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, Dave. I was just re-skimming it this morning before the podcast. And there were tons of things in it that we didn't get to talk about, but we got to hit on some high points. I mean, we took a dump on peanut butter, which was my main goal. So I'll see you soon, my man.
Nice. See you soon, man.